Hello, and welcome to the PPP and Important M&A Issues webinar by Pulcinella. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website as well as our COVID-19 blog. If you have questions regarding today's content, please type your question in the Q&A box or reach out to our COVID-19 support email. This contact information can be found on our COVID-19 blog. To access the COVID-19 blog, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box for assistance. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Pulcinella shareholder Phil Fagan.
Good afternoon and welcome. We're happy to be presenting another webinar in our series of PPP-related webinars. Today's topic, we're going to be talking about PPP loans in the context of M&A or asset purchase transactions. You'll note that a lot of what we do today skews more to the purchaser side because there's more issues as a purchaser, a buyer, to be aware of in a transaction. But a lot of these things are equally as applicable to if you're on the seller side. And you should also know and expect, if you're a seller, what a buyer may be expecting. So why don't we jump into it? A couple other things. If you need to reach any of us for questions that don't get answered during today's webinar, it's probably best to copy all of us, and one of us will get back to you. All of our emails are on the introduction slide. You can also find them at the Pulcinella website. So please don't be bashful about reaching out, and we'll get right back to you. The other thing is just a quick update of what's going on in the PPP world. Over the weekend, the president signed a bill that Congress passed, which extended the PPP program in its current form till August 8th. So there's still a pool of about $150 billion worth of money left. If folks want to apply for loans, they can do that up to August 8th. The other thing is, if you don't know already, a list was released yesterday. And we've posted on our blog about it, or about to, of all the folks who received PPP loans in the past. There's greater disclosure for those who are over $150,000 in loans, and it gives the names and the range of loans that that people receive. That can be helpful in doing due diligence or just in general. It appears that we don't know for certain, but it appears that if you return the loan in the period that was given to return the safe harbor to return the loan, that disclosure of those companies was not, in fact, made. And the last thing I wanted to mention before we get into it is in discussions with some people at the SBA this morning, there is a possibility that Congress will be adopting a PPP2 later on this summer, which is designed at smaller companies who qualify, and a lot less exceptions will be available for that. So the rules will be more like a 7A loan type. And in its current form, it has a forgiveness feature, but it hasn't been proposed in Congress yet. It's just something that's being discussed. Having said all that, let's move on to what we're going to cover today. Today, we're going to look at issues to flag if you're involved in an M&A transaction. Then we're going to talk about due diligence considerations and what you need to know, what you should think about, and what you should pay attention to if there is a PPP loan involved in the transaction. Finally, we're going to talk about what's made up in the purchase agreement, just like a typical purchase agreement. How do you do the PPP related language in a purchase agreement, reps and warranties, the covenants, the indemnification features, potentially establishing an escrow, and then what happens if there's leftover funds, what does the buyer or potentially the seller do with those funds when they're left over. So that's a makeup of what we're going to do today. We're also, within each of these sections, we're going to weave in some tax advice. We have our partner, Bill Sanders, who's the head of our tax group and probably the one of the most entertaining tax attorneys I know, who will be weaving in that advice. So a little extra bonus there. So issues to flag, let's talk about that. First, I would start with, when is your transaction closing? If it's closing before a PPP, before the borrower obtained a PPP loan, or now that the transaction or the timeframe has been extended, the important thing to know about that, if you're looking at a seller, is that once you sign a contract for the transaction, the buyer will be considered an affiliate. And so when you're testing to get that PPP loan, you have to consider the information and of the number of employees and the financial information about the buyer when doing that. A little bit of a quirk in the rules is you also have to consider existing affiliates as well. So that makes up an interesting interpretation of the rules. Then you also should look at what happens if the transaction closes after a bar obtains the loan, but before the bar applies for forgiveness. So in that situation, the folks in the transaction involved are saying, okay, what do we know about forgiveness? What can we count on related to forgiveness? How is this going to affect our transaction? Because at this point, we know there's a loan. We don't know whether all or part of the forgiveness will be achieved. And how do we deal with that in structuring a transaction? And then maybe an easier to deal with situation, but still something to deal with is, all right, we know what the forgiveness is. We know that there was a borrower, the loan was paid back, or at least we know what the forgiveness is. How do we deal with that going forward? And is there anything that is hanging over even after the forgiveness that as a borrower, I need to be worried about, I'm sorry, as a buyer, I need to be worried about of what could come back and cause a problem in the future? So first of all, what is going to cause an issue? Any change of control issue in general, and this is based on many of the loan documents that we have seen, the PPP loan documents, as well as the standard PPP loan documents that the SBA put out. And you need to realize some banks created their own documents, some used the language that the SBA put out, so it could be different for any specific transaction. But what you need to realize and what you need to look at is whether you need bank consent. And in almost all of the situations that we've experienced, you do need bank consent. And what does that mean? Well, it means that the change of controls has been a default. And in order to continue with the transaction, with the bank's permission, you need a waiver for the event of default. You can look carefully in the event of default section, and it may be that the bank didn't put it out there, but in general, we found it in just about every case. So just like any other outstanding loan that would be out there when you're doing an acquisition, you have to treat the bank as a normal lender, and you have to deal with and how are you going to handle the bank's ability to have a default, which generally means they can call the loan and ask that it be repaid immediately unless they agree to waive that. The other thing to know about the bank default is a lot of banks that we've been dealing with and that we've seen aren't sure how to handle this situation. The reason they're not sure how to handle this situation is the SBA has not taken a position on whether bars can undergo a change of control and how that would affect eligibility for forgiveness. What does that mean? They haven't taken a position. There's no language out there that addresses it. So some folks are saying, well, there's no language out there that addresses it. That means we can go ahead and do it because there's nothing that prohibits it. There is a provision in the 7A program itself, which is the underlying program that the PPP was run through, but it was obviously created different, that said you have to notify the SBA and your local regional department of the SBA under a 7A loan when there is going to be a change in control. Now, that actual provision of the 7A regulations has expired. It expired in April. So what does that leave us with? That leaves us with a big unknown. What do you do? Is there any guidance on it? And I think there's two ways to look at it. You could move forward and not notify the SBA and take a risk, or you could notify the regional office of the SBA under the 7A guidelines and see what they say. And I think a lot of that's going to be up to your bank, the bank where you have the loan, because they're the ones that have to deal with the event of default and how they're going to consider how to respond to you. My practical advice on that, if you were the buyer in a transaction, is get that done early, go to the bank, have the seller go to the bank and find out what's going to happen and what their position is going to be, because you don't want to be in the middle of your transaction or towards the end and say, oh, we have this open issue that we haven't dealt with, and now what do we do? All right. Sarah, I think you're going to talk about timing of closing.
I am, and this kind of builds off what Phil was mentioning about at the outset about the timing of transactions. There's three main issues to flag when you're thinking about when to time the transaction. The first is two different ways there could be a reduction in forgiveness, and the third is how the proceeds are used. So if you time the transaction during the covered period, and now the covered period was initially 8 weeks, but borrowers can now elect to have a 24-week covered period. So that really could extend the timeline during which a borrower would still be using the proceeds and still would be potentially subject to all of the SBA requirements related to FTEs. So if the buyer is taking on the PPP loan, but not the employees, there could be a reduction due to a reduced full-time equivalent FTE count. So what does that look like? If the buyer takes on the PPP loan and they have a lower FTE count than the borrower, then there is a potential that they would see a proportional reduction in forgiveness. And how that works is you look at your average monthly FTEs during the covered period, and you compare it to your average monthly FTEs from either January 1st to February 29th, 2020, or February 15th to June 30th, 2019. And if that look back date period has a higher FTE count than during the covered period, you're going to have a proportional reduction in your forgivable amount. So your maximum forgivable amount will be multiplied by that fraction. It's potentially problematic if the buyer has fewer employees, because at that point you really are looking at a likely reduction in the total forgivable amount. It's also an issue if the buyer does not take the PPP loan but does take the employees, and so the seller is left with the PPP loan but a lower amount of employees, possibly down to zero. There is some mitigation in the sense that it is an average. So, you know, let's say that the borrower elects to have the 24-week period and they have, you know, full FTEs for most of it, and then the seller takes on their employees. Averaged out, it won't be as bad of a reduction as it would be if that counted for the entire time, but it's still likely to be a reduction. And so that's really important for the borrower or whoever is assuming the loan to really take into consideration, because obviously, you know, you would want to maximize forgiveness. I'll also note that there is kind of an ambiguity here of the SBA came out and said that if you elect the 24-week period, that you can apply for forgiveness prior to the end of that 24 weeks. So as soon as you've used all the loan proceeds, you can apply for forgiveness. Any salary reductions that have occurred up to that point will be as though they lasted the entire period, but they didn't address what happens with FTEs. Now, it somewhat defies logic that you could potentially be penalized for reducing your FTE count after applying for forgiveness, but because the SBA hasn't addressed it, it is a possibility. So, you know, that's really important to bear in mind. The other thing that's important to bear in mind is how to use the proceeds. You know, if the borrower no longer has any employees due to the transaction, but still retains the PPP loan, they may not be able to use all of the proceeds in a way that would maximize forgiveness. Because without, you know, they have to have at least 60% of the amount spent during the covered period be payroll costs. So while they could spend, you know, whatever proceeds they have left on non-payroll costs, it's more likely that they wouldn't have a fully forgivable loan. So that's another thing to bear in mind when thinking of the timing of the transaction and how early in the covered period the transaction would close and potentially employees would move over. We have seen some transaction structures such that employees will not transition over until after the covered period as a way to kind of potentially mitigate that FTE issue. So that's something that's important to bear in mind. Phil, do you want to talk about successor liability? Phil?
Sure, Sarah. To your last point that you were making, we've also seen transactions that are structured where the borrower is brought in, you buy the stock, and you keep them as a subsidiary. So you're changing the ownership, but you're not changing who has the loan. So you keep the borrower at the subsidiary level, correct?
Yes.
But even then, you still have to deal with the FTE issues, or would you not if you kept all the employees down at the subsidiary level?
If you keep them down at the subsidiary level and the loan sits there as well, you likely not have to deal with the FTE issue as much. It's really about thinking about the entity that holds the loan and their employee count.
Okay, great. This next issue about if you structured an asset purchase, we just want to bring to your attention, don't want to spend too much time on it, that sometimes people think, okay, if we just carve this liability out, so we leave it with the sellers, either leave it in the seller entity and take everything else out, or we leave it, or we leave a few things with the seller. That can be done sometimes, but there's just a general corporate concept of you could be deemed to have a de facto merger where you're taking everything and you're just leaving one specific liability, and in fact, what you're really doing is a merger, and the buyer could be liable for that. So in structuring your merger and thinking about, okay, I'll leave just the liability behind as opposed to taking over the whole entity and leaving it as a subsidiary, or leaving some things behind, it's important that you talk to counsel and you figure out how you're structuring it so you as the buyer don't somehow become liable for a note that you left behind based on the way you structured it. And we'll talk in a little bit about other things that you can do besides a structure like that that might be a more safe way to handle it and less risk of it being deemed to be a merger.
So another really important thing to consider with respect to the PPP loans is the audit risk of the borrower. So the SBA has said that it will audit all PPP loans of over $2 million. It is also likely that they will audit all PPP loans in which an affiliate group has loans of more than $2 million. In the loan forgiveness application, one of the questions that the borrower has to respond to is whether or not the entity itself has a loan of more than $2 million, or whether along with its affiliate it has loans of more than $2 million. So it's not sufficient to just look at the loan that the borrower itself got, but it's also important to make sure that you understand the universe of its affiliates and what loan amounts they received, if any. The really important thing about the timing is that audits can occur at any time in the 6 years following the end of the covered period. So if a borrower elects a 24-week covered period, and that means that the SBA has that whole 24-week period plus an additional 6 years to conduct an audit. We are really, really suggesting that borrowers have all of their documentation put together now. The worst-case scenario is the SBA comes back in 2025 and asks for all of these documents that either the seller doesn't have for whatever reason, or they were never documented. And so a couple of things that are included in that documentation package is an affiliation analysis, an analysis of why the borrower was eligible at the time of the application. Also looking at economic need. You know, the SBA has said that if you have less than $2 million in loans, that you're unlikely they're not going to assume that you have an economic need. So, or they're not going to assume that you didn't have an economic need. It's still important to have the documentation there. We really suggest having a pretty full file, and anyone that is taking on the loan or is, you know, acquiring the entity as a whole should make sure that they have that documentation.
Great. One other thing to take into account when you're talking about issues to flag and thinking about doing the acquisition, the merger, is the process by which the SBA or the bank can deny forgiveness. So when you file a forgiveness application, the bank has 60 days to send it to the SBA. During that period of time, they can, say, request additional information. They can deny the forgiveness, or they can just send it on to the SBA for approval. And one of the issues they may have in denying forgiveness is what we talked about earlier, is if you had an event of default and you didn't get a waiver for them. Another issue are some of the things that Sarah was just saying that you need to document. If they had a question of eligibility, if they go through your documents and determine you didn't calculate forgiveness correctly, so they disagree with your numbers. Typically, if they're going to disagree with your numbers, they're going to sit down with you, talk about it, make sure that they understand, because the bank is really a conduit to getting it to the SBA. They're not supposed to come up with substantive reasons. They're supposed to say, okay, did you do the math right? Did you include what the SBA is asking for? Once they give it to the SBA has 90 days to determine whether you get forgiveness or not. So question becomes, in talking about your transaction and determining when you're going to close, people are saying, well, I'll just wait till after we find out about forgiveness. Well, that could be 5 months. That could take 60 days with the bank and another 90 days with the SBA. And then if there's an appeal process, how are you going to do deal with the appeal process? Are you going to allow the seller to appeal? Are you, as the borrower who potentially took on the loan, going to appeal? Those are things that you have to think about in timing, think about in drafting the purchase agreement, and putting in clauses to deal with what happens in each of these scenarios. The other thing to point out here is we think there'll be additional guidance on the appeal process, and as that comes out, that may help dealing with this in a purchase agreement in the context of planning for your transaction. So now we're going to hear from the tax man, Mr. Bill Sanders.
Thanks, Phil. And thanks for that introduction. I really appreciate that, although I'm sure for many people out there, the terms entertaining and tax lawyer together seem to be a sure oxymoron. Okay, so relative to the PPP loan program on the tax side, the provisions in the CARE Act were very thoughtful in terms of not taking away after giving. In other words, the legislation was clear that the loan forgiveness part of the PPP program would not cause taxable income. So providing a real benefit without then having to come out of pocket to pay taxes on the forgiveness side. Unfortunately, the IRS, in its infinite wisdom, not long thereafter came out with guidance that indicated that it may not be taxable income by virtue of the loan forgiveness, but the expenses associated with the loan forgiveness qualification would not be deductible under other tax theories, other provisions in the code. That was clearly met with disdain by congressional leaders because it cut really into what was intended to be a non-taxable benefit to those in need. And at this point, there's been a number of bills which have contained provisions which would eliminate that possibility. They've not made it to the point where they've gotten passed yet, but we anticipate that that will happen. Until that does happen, however, we need to keep in mind that those expenses are not deductible at this point. Okay, a couple of other things that were in the CARES Act, not really directly related to the PPP, some of them are indirectly related. There were a number of credits which came about in the first two, actually the second and third relief provisions. One of them was the employer retention payroll tax credit. There were two other ones in addition to that, sick pay leave credit and the family leave credit. And those had some significant credits that were available as well. The employer retention payroll tax credit, however, has very fact-specific provisions which make not only the application of the provision somewhat suspect, but also the calculation of the credit is very subject to potential scrutiny and dispute by the IRS. So this is certainly something to look at in any M&A transaction to the extent that these credits have been taken on the 941 for the target that needs to give special consideration. When we get through the due diligence piece, I'll talk about how we can confirm that that has been calculated correctly. Another huge item is the employer's share of Social Security deferral. There was a point in time where if you had a PPP loan forgiven, you didn't qualify for this prospectively. That was changed in subsequent legislation, indicating that irrespective of whether there's loan forgiveness, the employer's share of Social Security can be deferred and paid at a later date. This applies to all employer share of Social Security for employees between March 27th and December 31st of 2020. Those numbers can be so significant, particularly for large employers, that care needs to be taken relative to having to pay those when the time comes, half in 2020, at the end of 2021 and half at the end of 2022. The IRS should never be a creditor, and so appropriate provisions need to be put in place to make sure that those can be paid in a timely fashion. The last thing in the CARES Act, which was really relevant, has to do with NOLs. In 2018, the law was changed to provide that no carryback of NOLs would be allowed after that date, and any carryforwards were limited to 80% of the net income for that particular year. The CARES Act had a provision which allows now for carryback of losses incurred in 2018, 19, or 20, 5 years. So the 18 loss can be carried back to 2013. Conceivable, since this is still a very new piece of legislation, that a target might have an asset there that they haven't taken advantage of yet, so that needs to be considered as part of the transaction. And then any losses that are being incurred during the year in which the transaction might close should also be considered, because part of those would be carried back pre-transaction and part perhaps post-transaction. Although NOLs can arise in a variety of different circumstances, for the most part, those are going to be in C-Corp settings. So this would generally apply only when the target is a C-corporation. Okay, I think it's time for us to talk about due diligence.
Yeah, that's right, Bill. So we looked at all the potential issues that you could flag. You thought about structuring it. Now you're going to dive in and do the due diligence. And what do you want to know about the potential PPP loan? And I think you'd want to know whether you were a buyer. Well, of course, if you're a buyer, but if you're a seller, if you're receiving cash that you wouldn't be able to get at closing, or if you're receiving stock, you would want to know about the buyer's PPP loan as well, to the extent that that was going to become an issue down the road if there's skin in the game. So, you know, we would start with the initial threshold issues that a PPP borrower had to go through. So confirming the size, looking at the loan application, and the documents that supported it. They're not a tremendous amount of documents. It's easy to ask somebody for, and they should be able to give it for you. But you can't assume that everything is correct on there. So you have to ask the questions and see how they got to why are you eligible. And remember, that can be because of less than 500 employees, or that could be based on a size test. And there are two size tests, one related to the NAICS code of the borrower, one the SBA's general alternative size test. So you want to find out why the person who was getting the loan, or the entity that was getting the loan, believed that they were eligible. This is a big one, the next one. We're going to make sure that, A, they did an affiliation analysis, and if they did it, it was correct. And so the list of all affiliates should be on Schedule A to the PPP loan. It should be easy to find out. If they didn't have or file a Schedule A, then they were incorrect in not doing that. That's not necessarily awful. That means you should do it now and figure it out, so that if they're audited and the auditors say, well, why didn't you do an affiliation analysis, you're able to document that even had they done the analysis, they would have qualified. And things to remember are affiliates include folks who control 50% of the stock, or some type of minority right that give them ability to block certain day-to-day activities, ability to block holding a quorum. And once you've determined that there's an affiliate, a controlled person, you have to determine whether that controlled person has any other affiliates that need to be included in the analysis. So very much like tax, it's important to bring in a PPP expert to just make sure you're looking for the right things when doing that. And then there's question of economic need. You probably know from the press, and if you've been involved with a PPP loan, that it went back and forth whether there needed to be, then what were the penalties. Where it ended up is there's a safe harbor for people who got loans under $2 million that the government would assume that there was economic need that was necessary. Over $2 million, or potentially if a group of an affiliate that combined got over $2 million, they would need to show that. Our recommendation is that you look at economic need for anybody who got a loan, just to make sure for yourself that you're satisfied that there aren't any issues with economic need related to the loan. We also say that if there isn't current documentation, have the seller document the economic need. So as Sarah previously pointed out, if you're audited, you'd be able to down the road go back and say, hey, here's why they thought they needed this loan. And as I said earlier, it's important to understand the economic need of a buyer doing the transaction, given how do they have the cash to do the transaction if they also had need that required a loan. That doesn't mean that it automatically means they couldn't have done it. It just means take a look at that issue.
So when conducting due diligence, it's going to be important to make sure that the borrower has correctly use the proceeds of the loan. Using the proceeds for anything other than these four listed things is considered a misuse of funds and could result in, you know, SBA enforcement actions. So the first is that they need to have used proper payroll costs. There has been a lot of recent guidance about payroll costs for owner employees, and the SBA broke it down by entity type. So there are different limits for C-Corp owner employees, S-Corp owner employees, general partners, managing members. And these include whether or not you can count the employer retirement portion and the employer healthcare portion into the payroll cost for that employee. So it's really important to bear to understand what the limitations are on the payroll cost. Additionally, if they went from, if the borrower elected a 24-week period instead of an 8-week period, that changes the cap for employees. For owner employees, the maximum it moves from about $15,000 to about $20,000, and for other employees, it moves from about $15,000 to about I think it's $48,000. So it's a big jump in the potential amount that you can pay each employee. Bearing in mind, of course, that they still need to make an annualized amount of less than $100,000. So if you elect the 24-week period but use your loan proceeds within 10 weeks, then you do need to make sure that what you pay them annualized is under that $100,000 cap. You can't just go all the way to the maximum for the W-2 employees. Again, payroll costs does not include 1099 contractors, and the loan should not be used to pay them because they themselves can obtain the loan. Three other non-payroll costs are mortgage interest on BLO personal property, for mortgages in place by February 15th, any rent on real or personal property leases in place by February 15th, and utilities for utility contracts in place by February 15th. It's really important that that February 15th date be respected. So if the borrower moved at any time and so has a new lease, new utilities, new mortgage interest, that's not going to be considered an eligible payroll cost or non-payroll cost. It's also important to understand whether the borrower used a cash or accrual method. Either is acceptable, but it needs to be consistent. So just really making sure that the funds were used appropriately and that it was all documented. Because again, if the SBA comes back and looks at how the loan was used, you want to make sure that you can show receipts. You know, we've said at the outset that it's easier if the borrower has a separate account, but that's not always possible. But either way, there should be clear accounting of exactly how the loan proceeds were used.
Okay, so now you know, or you've done your diligence to see what loan they applied for, how much was the loan, were they eligible for the loan, and then did they use the proceeds and follow the rules in a manner? So that gives you a box of, okay, here's the dollar amount, here's what we think they could get for forgiveness, but then you need to decide, are there going to be any reductions that are applied to that? And the way you do that is, and we're not going to go over it in our other webinars, we've gone over how you get forgiveness. But the general things you want to ask are, yeah, are they using the 8-week period to spend the money, or have they increased it to the 24-week period that Congress allowed you to do when they made the recent changes? And one of the discussions you can have is, if they haven't thought about the 24-week period, is that beneficial to the way this transaction is going to go, and does it fit in with the planning for this transaction? Then you need to determine, are they going to be able to spend all of the money properly, and have they used the right ratio of at least 60% on compensation, if not more, and will they be able to get as much forgiveness as possible? If they didn't do at least 60%, that doesn't mean that they've haven't followed the rules. It just means they won't be able to get full forgiveness, and you need to think about that when pricing the transactions. And then, as Sarah was talking about earlier, you need to look at were there any salary reductions or reductions in FTE that would cause the borrower to not get full forgiveness, so that you can price that out when you're making an offer. Bill, you want to talk about doing tax due diligence?
Sure. So pretty much mirror what I hit on earlier now on the due diligence side. So relative to the PPP program, absent that legislative correction that I talked about earlier, and as part of the due diligence process, need to confirm that the expenses giving rise to loan forgiveness haven't been deducted in computing taxable income. And that's taxable income on a return that's already been filed, or for purposes of the tax accrual that might be inherent in the computation for the M&A transaction. Probably the biggest one is to scrutinize records relating to qualification for the various credits that were became available by virtue of the CARES Act. Once again, there's three credits, the sick pay leave credit, the family leave credit, and then the employer retention payroll tax credit. That last one, once again, is the one that I think is more fact specific, will require a lot more confirmation. You have to initially qualify for that by either being fully or partially suspended, or you have a reduction in gross receipts of 50% or more from the quarter at the prior year. The first piece of that test is a little bit squishy. We think it's going to be easier to meet than not. But the actual computation is the part where you have to get into fact specifics. If you're less than 100 employees, it's no big deal, because pretty much all of the wages paid up to $10,000 per employee is going to be eligible. But over 100 employees, you're only allowed the credit for wages paid to employees when they are not providing services. And that determination is a lot more difficult than it might sound. If you're on a time clock or you're working every other day and so forth, fairly easy. But if you're not on one of those, and the question is, how many hours did you work during a day? That person's remote. It gets a little complicated in terms of how to document that and be able to prove that up. Just to give you an example of how much attention the IRS has given to this already, in one of its Q&As that addressed a lot of issues, but this was one of the primary focuses, there was over 100 Q&As. So they're clearly focusing on this. In addition to that, confirmation that the employer share of FICA has been properly computed and that amount is shown appropriately on the financial statements. And then on the NOLs, to investigate whether or not there's the ability to carry back some losses if it's a C corporation back to a prior year, and that'll just require looking at the various tax returns. So that leads us now to the purchase agreement and provisions in there.
Yeah, so thanks, Bill. Now, we've talked about that everything that you looked at, everything that you did your due diligence on. How do you provide for it in the purchase agreement, and how do you deal with it? So one basic way that anybody who's familiar with doing transactional work knows is reps and warranties, and how you then put the person who's making the reps, the seller in most cases, on the hook if something you looked at was incorrect. If they didn't make the right rep and warranty, and an ability to go back to them, either if you put a escrow in place or you have them survive the transaction, or they're a condition to completing the transaction, and say, hey, you didn't do this correctly, you rep that you did, so there needs to be some sort of financial penalty for that. The biggest one related to PPP is probably the one at the bottom, which is the seller used the PPP loans in accordance with the CARES Act. That's about as broad as you can get. That covers anything that they use the money for, and makes sure that they only use the money for what they're supposed to, which is, as we've talked about previously, payment of salaries and then certain types of rent, mortgage interest, and things like transportation and other benefits provided to employees. You also want them to say, hey, they were eligible and they correctly determined their loan amount, that they were truthful in their application, that they provided true and complete copies of the documentation to you, so you know everything you got in due diligence was everything they had. And then this one relates to necessary waivers, approvals, and consents. We've encountered a couple issues related to that. One is, did they get the consents within the company to do this? And then also externally, if you needed a banker's consent, if you needed consent from someone else who owed the seller a loan. So don't forget the fact that they had other debt in place, probably prohibited from getting the PPP loan, but most lenders were issuing waivers to do that. So not only internal, but external approvals as well. Sarah?
There are also a couple of covenants that we suggest adding in. You know, if the closing occurs after the cover period, then you would want a covenant that the seller is going to use all the proceeds as required under the CARES Act. So that is for those four things, the payroll and non-payroll costs. Again, if the closing occurs after the cover period, you want to ensure that in the interim, the seller is taking all commercially reasonable steps to maximize loan forgiveness. Whether or not the closing occurs before, after, or during the covered period, it's important to make sure that the seller is maintaining all of their records for at least 6 years, or at the very least is providing the buyer with a copy of all the records. Again, you know, the SBA has that 6-year time period to come back and review all the loans, and so it's important to make sure that that documentation is available. And then finally, that if the closing occurs after the covered period, that the seller will apply for forgiveness within the stated period of time after the end of the covered period or prior to the end of the covered period. So what is the stated period of time? That is really up to the buyer and the seller to determine. In order to continue to benefit from the deferral of any interest or principal payments, the borrower needs to apply for forgiveness within 10 months of the covered period. You know, presumably most buyers would not want the seller to take that much time to apply for forgiveness, but it may be important depending on your industry. There are a couple of carve-outs that if you are unable to return to the level of business prior that you had prior to February 15th, because of different compliance with OSHA regulations or CDC or HHS regulations by December 31st, that's considered a mitigation of any inability to bring back up the FTE count. So it is possible that for some borrowers, they may want to wait a little bit longer to apply for forgiveness to determine whether they're eligible for some of the carve-outs for the FTE reduction. But that's really going to be important conversation between buyer and seller in determining what timing is appropriate given the borrower's industry, given its business structure, given how it's going economically, and whether they want to wait for any mitigation or whether they just want to move forward with forgiveness. So that covenant's going to be really important in making sure that the borrower is applying for forgiveness at a time that the seller and the buyer agree is appropriate.
Hey, Sarah, one other thing on the one of the covenants you had in there with a little more detail. I think we're also suggesting specifically that if there's an audit, that the seller agrees to comply with the audit, not just to maintain the records for 6 years, but that they'll do everything to comply with necessary for the audit.
Agreed. And I think another one that we discussed earlier is including, you know, how you would handle any sort of audit or how you would handle any sort of denial of forgiveness and including that in the purchase agreement as well.
Okay, let's talk about what would be your typical tax representations, warranties, and covenants. In a nicely drafted, tight set of reps and warranties and covenants that cover tax matters, generically these issues that we've discussed earlier in the presentation and that are covered here would cover those situations. But because there's so much potential risk here, the thought is to have special provisions relating to these in addition to the standard reps and warranties. So the first one, of course, is that the expenses that have been given rise to the loan forgiveness haven't been deducted unless the law has changed. With respect to the employer retention tax credit and the employer share of Social Security deferred, that those amounts have been computed according to, and then just generally speaking, the CARES Act and any published guidance, which would cover, once again, all the things that the IRS has put out there and how they interpret these things, including that 100-plus Q&A publication. In addition to that, the NOLs and making sure if there are some embedded assets that are available by virtue of the carryback of the NOLs, that those would be addressed in the reps and warranties and covenants as to who they belong to, and that the cost associated with the defense of any of the above is borne by the appropriate party. Generally speaking, that's going to be the selling party. And as the next slide will show, that's also a part of the indemnification provisions that you would have in there as well. So speaking of indemnification, if we can move on to that now.
Sure. So in the indemnification section, it's important to make sure that the seller is going to indemnify the buyer against very particular PPP issues. The first is any ineligibility, including due to affiliation issues. You know, hopefully that's rooted out in due diligence, but so important to have. The next is noncompliance with the terms of the loan, which likely would be a misuse of funds, so just using the loan proceeds in any way that you're not allowed to do so, which falls into improper use of funds or proceeds. So that's more specific. The noncompliance can also include any of the terms of the promissory note that are not complied with. Indemnify the buyer against any audit or investigation by the SBA that has a negative result. That's going to be very important, particularly if you believe that the borrower is at a heightened risk for an audit by the SBA. And then finally, as Bill mentioned, any costs and taxes owed by virtue of any IRS notice, adjustment, or examination related to any of the CARES Act tax provisions. So, Phil, do you want to talk about the escrow concept?
Sure. And this is really a way to, we've talked about how do you protect yourself, but how do you financially protect yourself if something goes wrong in structuring this? Because this is based on something's going to potentially happen after you close a deal, meaning the forgiveness part of the loan. And one of the things I should have mentioned earlier is a lot of ways people protect themselves is getting reps and warranties insurance. It's been our experience so far that none of the insurers are willing to do reps and warranties insurance with respect to the PPP loans just because it's so new they can't get their hands on what the potential liabilities are. But one way you can specifically handle this issue is, say you had a $2 million loan that the seller had, you were paying a significant purchase price, you could put $2 million or some other amount into an escrow account, and you'd say, hey, once you get the forgiveness, everything comes out dollar for dollar from the amount that's forgiven. To the extent it's not forgiven, partially or all, then that becomes money that either used to pay the loan back or goes back to the buyer who would pay the loan back. So that's a way to handle it and deal with this hangover. I mean, a lot of sellers might be uncomfortable with that, and there's a lot of potential liability related to it. But we've been seeing that used in transactions. The only thing it doesn't cover is, as we talked about before, say 5 months from now you get your decision and the escrow gets released. If you're subsequently audited 5 or 6 years down the road, you probably in that case would have to rely on indemnification provisions to go after the seller. You want to quickly do leftover funds so then we can answer any questions, Sarah?
Sure. So it's important to determine what happens if there are any leftover funds. So either because the borrower hasn't been able to spend all the money or because they haven't gotten full forgiveness. So it's important to determine whether the loan will be immediately paid back. If it won't be, will it be covered by the escrow, or does the seller just want to retain the loan itself? So that's something that should be covered in purchase agreement as a potential outcome of the forgiveness application. So now we're going to take a couple of questions.
Yeah. So, Sarah, I'll jump in and take the first one. Question was, if you are the buyer and have a PPP loan of $1.7 million and the seller has a $500,000 loan, does the SBA consider that as over $2 million? So we don't know for certain, but when you get really going to depend on when you go for forgiveness, because if you've consummated the transaction, it asks on the forgiveness application how many loans, the dollar amount of your loans and your affiliate loans. We believe that if you answer that question, it's over $2 million, they would likely audit you based on that. So I would have to assume, but we don't know for sure. It would be safe to assume that you could get audited in that scenario. You want to take the next one, Sarah?
Sure. So the question is, if you file for forgiveness before the 24 weeks is up, do you have to prorate the maximum salary level for the number of weeks that has passed? The answer is yes, because you need to make sure that annualized an employee doesn't make over the $100,000 annualized. So even though there is a new maximum that was put out, that was assuming that you used it over the 24-week period. So it's still important to continue to make sure that annualized your employee makes less than $100,000.
Sarah, you want to do the next one as well? It's not an M&A transaction. Somebody's sneaking in a question we continually get because it's a little confusing. So why don't you take that next one, Sarah?
So the question is, what's the maximum amount that an LLC S-Corp owner can receive its salary? If it's 8 weeks, then it's $15,000. If it's 24, it's around $20,000. And similar to other employees, you need to make sure that annualized is no more than either A, that cap, or B, $100,000 annualized. There is pretty particular SBA guidance on this that we would recommend looking at.
Okay.
So do you want to talk about economic need?
Yeah. So this question says, how's the economic need going to be evaluated by the SBA when a recipient of PPP funds makes an acquisition? For example, is the SBA going to interpret that a recipient should not be capable of making an acquisition during a covered period if they were a recipient in funds? So the answer is there is no requirement that you have little to no funds left when you get a PPP loan. So the first thing you have to look at is, hey, at the time of the application, which is what the SBA is supposed to look at, was there an economic need, and did you document it, and was there a reasonable case for showing there was an economic need? If you were sitting on a pile of cash that you could have used to pay your employees, there may not have been an economic need. You got the loan, and now you use it for a transaction. But there's also an argument that you had planned the transaction. You were looking at it. It's important for the need of your business, and you got the loan to keep your employees in place, and you're also, you know, had the transaction planned. So I'd say the answer is, it's not certain. Well, you need to be able to make a case at the time of the loan you needed the money and how you planned for it and whether you had the acquisition planned or not and why the acquisition still made sense and you were able to do it while having the economic need. That's not that's a very gray area answer, but my advice is if you can go through put in a memo why you had the economic need, justify it, and you believe your board also agrees with that, you can make a case to the SBA that you needed it and you still needed the cash for an acquisition. Sarah, do you have the next one?
Yeah, I think it kind of dovetails into what you were speaking about is if the employer shows a profit at the time the loan is accepted or during the first half of the year, will that affect forgiveness? Not necessarily. That would mainly play into economic need, and so that would be part of the economic need analysis that Phil just talked through. Phil, do you want to quickly respond to our last question?
That's Bill Sanders.
I'm not seeing it pop up.
So, Bill, if the buyer has an ERTC and seller has a PPP loan, is buyer's ERTC adversely impacted? And if so, how to structure around where the relative benefits would be disproportional?
So there used to be a where you couldn't take advantage of both of those, but that was taken out of the law, so I don't think there's a problem with that.
So easy answer, don't worry about it because you can take advantage of both.
That's right.
So I think that takes up literally 30 seconds before the end of the webinar time, and we got the questions in. So Emma, we're going to turn it back to you. Thank everyone for attending, and we appreciate the ability to keep giving you this information. And please contact any one of us, again, best to put all of our names in an email when you're sending it. We'll get back to you.
Excuse me. Thank you, Phil. This concludes today's webinar. A copy of the presentation and slides will be available on the PulseNelly website as well as our COVID-19 blog.